and Answers begins right now.
Over the centuries, there have been many attempts to present an alternative explanation to the resurrection of Christ, and all have failed to provide an adequate explanation for the evidence. In recent days, a new explanation for the empty tomb has been proposed. The collective delusion theory states that the early Christians suffered from collective delusion. What is this theory about, and does it provide an adequate explanation for the empty tomb? You're tuned to Evidence and Answers radio broadcast with our host, Pat Zukran. Pat is an author, teacher, and international speaker in the area of Christian apologetics, the defense of the Christian faith. During our time together today, Pat and his fellow apologetics scholar, Dr. Doug Potter, discuss the collective delusion theory and see if it poses a major threat to the resurrection account of Christ. Now, with part one of this three-part interview, is our host, Pat.
You're listening to Evidence and Answers, where we provide compelling evidence for faith and hope in Christ and biblical answers to the issues of today. Well, over the centuries, there have been many attempts to present an alternative, naturalistic explanation to the resurrection of Christ. And so far, all have failed to provide an adequate explanation for the evidence we have. Well, in recent days, a new explanation for the empty tomb has been proposed, the collective delusion theory. And this one states that the early Christians suffered from collective delusion. Well, what is this theory about? And does it provide a challenging alternative explanation for the empty tomb? Well, to address this issue with us is apologist Dr. Doug Potter. Doug is a scholar, author, and speaker in the area of Christian apologetics. He earned his master's and doctorate in apologetics from Southern Evangelical Seminary, where he now serves as an assistant professor in apologetics and the director of the Doctorate of Ministry program there at Southern Evangelical Seminary. He is a fine speaker, a regular guest here on Evidence and Answers. So, Doug, welcome back to Evidence and Answers.
Hey, Pat, it's great to be with you. Thanks so much.
Yes, so we not only have Doug here on radio, but we also got him on video, and you can see the interview on YouTube here as well. Well, we're talking about the collective delusion argument, another proposed alternative naturalistic explanation for the resurrection. But before we go into the theory of the collective delusion, Doug, first give us the evidence for the resurrection that, you know, we're generally all agreed upon, no matter what persuasion, liberal, atheist, evangelical that you may be. What is the evidence we need to look at here?
Yeah, I'd be glad to do that. One of the things that is extremely important to recognize is that in approaching the resurrection, there's two primary things in a classical apologetic approach. Number one is an argument for the existence of God. That is, that theism is true. And if theism is true, then God can act or do a miracle, which a resurrection would be, in the world. Of course, if God doesn't exist, that's why it needs to be dealt with first, then there's no reason to talk about a resurrection, because that is indeed the hallmark sign of an act or a sign from God. So the first is to demonstrate the existence of God. The second thing is then to look at the historical evidence for the resurrection. The primary sources for that obviously are the New Testament. So it's required that we show that the New Testament is historically reliable in some sense, that what it tells us is going on in the first century is indeed going on. There's lots of evidence for the historic reliability of the New Testament, the Gospels, Paul's epistles that can be given. And then, of course, it's an examination of that evidence itself. What historical facts can be looked at with regards to the resurrection? And of course, there are several that can be looked at. Almost everybody agrees that there's an empty tomb with regards to the resurrection of Jesus. Everybody agrees that that is a known tomb in the ancient world. And everybody agrees that the disciples believed that they experienced the risen Lord himself. Those are the main facts that can be put forward. Along with that is also the fact that the disciples were changed in terms of their theology and belief system, radically moving from traditional Judaism into a belief that Jesus alone is the Messiah who offers salvation. Indeed, the establishment of the Christian church itself is a historical fact as a result of this belief of the disciples. And of course, you can put the disciples to the test because many of them, we know, with great certainty, gave their life with regards to being a martyr for the resurrection of Jesus. And of course, who would die for what they know to be false? In fact, the disciples did not do that. They died for what they knew to be the truth, and they're alone in the position of knowing whether or not Jesus rose from the dead. That's what makes their martyrdom different than everyone else. My martyrdom is worthless. It's nothing. I simply believe it. But they're in a position of knowing whether or not Jesus rose from the dead. We're talking about Peter and Paul and the rest of the apostles as well. So those are the main facts.
Yeah, Doug, I think you make a great point. I wanted to camp out a little bit because some people will say, well, people have died for false ideas and false religions before. People look at Muslims, you know, who die for what we agree is, you know, is a false ideology. But what you're saying is that people will not die for what they know to be a lie.
Right, exactly. Yeah, and they're in the position to do it. It's not that the disciples believe that Jesus rose from the dead and some faith that's based on evidence that people provided. They know, as we'll see in our talk today, we'll get into the fact that Jesus appeared to them over a 40-day period. He ate with them. They were able to touch him. This is something they know whether or not it was true. It's not something that is faith based on someone else's authority. They knew it directly and experienced him directly.
Yes. And so whatever explanation you try to give for that empty tomb has to somehow account for the evidence that you presented here. And over the centuries, there have been several, the swoon theory, that the women went to the wrong tomb. I think recently, John Dominic Crossan tried to propose that wild dogs ate the body of Jesus. The earliest, of course, is in Matthew's gospel, the disciples stole the body. And really, those have all failed to account for the evidence that's there. Really, the only one left is what we call the hallucination theory. You know, that's the only one I hear proposed in debates now. Really, that's really kind of the last man standing. So since the collective delusion theory is kind of a derivative of that, explain to us, you know, the hallucination theory a little bit.
The hallucination. In fact, it's not just a, you know, most hallucinations are individualized in terms of an experience, and it's grounded in some traumatic experience that someone's, like, if you have a loved one that dies, you're so affected by that psychological effect and other effects upon you that you start to imagine it a lot. And then eventually you think something is real with regards to actually seeing them again. That just doesn't exist with the disciples. First of all, it's collective. It's many people. At one time, as many as 500 people were gathered together that saw the risen Christ. It's on multiple occasions. It's not always when they're afraid. They experience joy and release and a love of Christ and his coming back over a 40-day period. They ate with him. So it's not this one traumatic trance or something like that that they go into. It's multiple periods, different geographic locations. And when you try to apply what we understand about hallucinations into that setting, it just completely breaks apart. Doesn't hold up.
Yeah. So a lot of arguments are here are kind of variations of this hallucination theory. And we've got a new one here. It's the collective delusion theory. So Doug, tell us, what does this theory assert?
Yeah, basically this theory is going to assert that, you know, if a lot of people realize that the paranormal is very extensive today. People believe in it and people say that they experience it. Most scientists and sociologists investigating it would see that a lot of this is delusional. That is, there's really no real phenomenon that's going on. It's just a, and since many people claim it and many people are experiencing it, they look at this as being a collective delusion. We'll kind of take this paranormal experience, whether we're talking about UFOs or ghosts or whatever it happened to be, the experience, and let's impose at least the characteristics of what those groups are manifesting onto the first century. and take a look at them in terms of seeing if we can find in obviously the New Testament, because that's our primary source at least, whether they display some of these characteristics with regards to collective delusion that we see to do today. And of course, if they do, then we're in the position of wanting to at least propose and investigate this further as to whether this is an explanation for their experience. So there's two senses in which you could kind of take this paranormal explanation. Either the disciples themselves are deluded in terms of having paranormal beliefs. Now, obviously, not the paranormal beliefs today, like UFOs. That's not it. But there are superstitions and magic and belief in spirits that exist in the Greco-pagan world. And maybe this has influenced them and they've been influenced by this. And this is what is delusional with regards to their understanding of Jesus and his resurrection. Or it's the case that someone could hold to the paranormal today and say that the paranormal back then actually affected them in some way. In fact, there's an interesting cartoon I saw years ago in a Josh McDowell brochure that was passed out that basically offered in that cartoon that aliens stole the body of Jesus. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And there was, you know, it was supposed to make everybody laugh and kind of just chuck it off as, you know, no one would hold that view. But you can just turn on your TV, just search the web, just go into social media. Everybody's talking about ghosts and UFOs and all kinds of and aliens. It's all over the place. Perhaps that being an explanation. Of course, that would be imposing what's happening here in the 21st century onto the first century, which ruins the historical context. But scholars do have an objection here. And that objection is that needs to be investigated. Do the earliest Christians, those that we read about in Acts especially, and even after that period, but primarily in the book of Acts, do they display what are common characteristics of delusion, a group delusion, a collective delusion, or is it just collective behavior that doesn't necessarily involve delusion? And so that's really what we need to dig in with regards to this somewhat new theory put forward.
Yeah, Doug, you know, when did you first come across this objection here to the resurrection of Christ?
Yeah, it's interesting. There was a debate on the resurrection of Jesus, and actually really good debate. You can probably find it on YouTube between apologist William Lane Craig and Gerd Ludemann, who's a very famous, well-known German New Testament critic. Excellent debate. Well, the debate itself took place, recorded, I'm sure it's on YouTube, but a book came out transcribing the debate, and they asked scholars to interact with the debate. One of those scholars, Michael Golder, who's actually another New Testament critic of the resurrection, proposed in his response that the early Christians displayed characteristics that are similar to collective delusion. Now, the debate took place in 2000. The book was published a little bit after that. So that was my first really scholarly exposure to this type of objection. And I kind of just put it in the back of my mind saying, hey, someone probably ought to respond to that. Well, here we are.
Yeah, Ludemann, he's a fine New Testament scholar, but isn't he from a naturalist worldview or an atheist?
Absolutely. Yeah. As far as I know, that is his background. And of course, anyone with that worldview background is going to try to come up with natural explanations. And of course, this one from Golder responding to Ludemann and Craig debate is just in that category of trying to find a naturalistic explanation to explain away the resurrection of Jesus.
Yeah. You know, going off on a side tangent here, some people may be wondering, how does a New Testament scholar, how can you be an atheist and a New Testament scholar? But actually, there's a lot of them out there. In fact, some of them wrote some pretty good commentaries on these New Testament books.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. As I teach a class and to undergraduate students in which we cover an introduction to theology, in which we go over worldviews. And one of the things I do is I say, of all the worldviews that are out there, you know, most atheism, pantheism, and theism, those are the three major ones, and there's offsprings of all three of those. I can point to New Testament critics and Old Testament critics that hold all of those. There are pantheists that study the New Testament. There are atheists that study the New Testament, or agnostics that study the New Testament. And of course, there are theists as well. So they come in all stripes with regards to their worldview. And that's something that must indeed be looked at in order to assess their evidence, their arguments, and so forth.
Yeah. So Doug, you know, what do contemporary studies then say about collective delusion?
Yeah, this is really interesting because Golder cites a book by Neil Smelzer called A Theory of Collective Behavior. And he says in that book that he calls this collective delusion, these characteristics, collective delusion, and put forward that's kind of the basis of this paranormal collective delusion type experience that is out there. But when I read Smelzer's book that's on collective behavior, he only cites one study, really interesting, one study that deals with this particular issue. And that particular study is known as the famous Seattle windshield pitting episode or epidemic. And this is something, you know, collective delusion is actually hard for social scientists to study because you've got to establish things very quickly. You can't study it after the fact. You've got to kind of establish, okay, it's a delusion. And then you've got to do a survey with regards to surveying people with regards to it over time, and then collecting all the data and putting it together and drawing a conclusion. But this Seattle windshield pitting epidemic that took place in the 1950s is looked at as probably one of the classic examples of collective delusion. So I took a look at this one that was done in Seattle that if you want to explore more about, we can. Or I also took some studies that were done in the Skeptical Inquirer, some articles that were written, and put together a bunch of characteristics. And I said, okay, these are the characteristics that basically come from these particular studies. And so let's then take these characteristics in mind and then kind of look into at least the primary source documents concerning the New Testament and see if they're present there and to what degree they may be present there, that it would at least raise concerns as to whether we should investigate it further for perhaps a cause or correlation related to collective delusion.
Yeah, tell us about that Seattle study there. What exactly was that?
It's really an interesting study that was done. We're talking about 1954, and this is in March, and this all kind of takes place within the time period, or at least the intensification takes place between March and April. What happens is people outside the city, like 80 or so miles outside the city, start to notice these black things on their windshield when they walk out in the morning or whenever they go out to their car, and they say or claim that it's creating these divots, these crevices in their windshield. Well, this causes a panic, so to speak. The police receive literally in about a month's time over 3,000 complaints from people outside the city, and then it grows inside the city with regards to all of these complaints. This issue gets so big that it goes to the governor of the state. And it goes all the way to the president. Yes, Eisenhower is president at the time in 1954. It goes all the way to him. The president of the United States issues an order, request, whatever, to look into it. So everybody starts to look at the social scientists, start to look into it. Obviously, the police go out. They start to investigate. They want to know what it is. Because the possible explanations for this, one of them is actually really significant. Months before this, in the South Pacific, they were doing H-bomb testings. That is, way back in the 1950s, they're actually above ground explosions of nuclear bombs. And obviously, we know today, and they even knew back then, that there's radiation from that. So one of the major concerns was that this is the result of radiation from these H-bomb tests in the South Pacific that have made their way all the way to the West Coast, and that it's evident on our windshields, going to lead to radiation poisonings. This is really significant back then with regards to them.
You know, you can see the parallels to the resurrection, that this zealous small group of disciples of Jesus, you know, in their zeal and excitement and persuasive power, convinced a significant amount, and it just kind of steamrolled from there. So yeah, you can kind of see the parallels there.
So that kind of leads us up to this cliffhanger, because the cliffhanger, the question is, what is this? Well, they were very quickly, the social scientists and labs that went out and got this off of the windshield, took it back to the lab and investigated it. And they said, you know, what in the world is what? It turns out that it's these cynosophers. That's what they're called. You say, what in the world is that? No one's ever heard of that. Well, it's a byproduct of the improper combustion of bituminous coal, which obviously is in these plants that are burning coal for fuel and power and so forth back then. It's actually quite common experience. It's actually goes on periodically in the region. It's just people were heightened with regards to the H-bomb testing and maybe other things that were going on that they attributed possibly to that, not remembering that this actually has happened over the years periodically off and on. So the social scientists have in place a known delusion. We know they're deluded. Now, when I gave a talk on this, I actually had someone come up to me that basically confronted me about the fact that that's not a good explanation for what went on out there. It was actually someone younger than me who I guess had looked into it, investigated it. So there's still people out there that are adamant about the fact that that's not a good explanation, but at least the scientists, the social scientists and officials were convinced it's just these sonosophers landing on the windshield and it's not really causing any damage to their windshields. But in doing this, they were able to literally call on the phone, ask questions to a wide variety of random people with regards to it and their views on it. And they were able to come up with some common characteristics of collective delusion that happens to be present. And again, as I mentioned, I've kind of collected these together from some other sources and said, okay, here's the main things. It's not the case that they have to all be present for collective delusion, but if they are all present, it does give us cause to need to look into this further as a possible explanation.
Yeah, so give us those characteristics. You know, what are those characteristics needed for collective delusion to occur?
Here they are, and not in any particular order, but I think it's a good order to kind of look at them at least one at a time, 7 or 8 of them. First of all, you've got to have belief in a phenomenon, belief in the paranormal, so to speak. You've got to have the ability for it to spread somewhat through mass media, at least in some sense that it can spread fairly quickly to a lot of people who become informed about it. And one of the characteristics that's in all of them is people at a low education level have this initial belief and then this persistent belief that they do not deviate from. So it's a low education level. It's instances of human perception being questioned or being fallible also exist with regards to collective delusion. And then timing becomes extremely important. There's this notion of the timing of the phenomenon and it taking place. In some sense, it must persist throughout time for people to adhere to it or believe it. It must continue to go on. And then there's group conformity, some panic that ensues. And then there's got to be, in some sense, for it to persist, some level of payoff for the participants itself, some sense that they gain something from it in terms of fame or money, notoriety, and so forth with regards to it. These seem to be the central characteristics of what are involved in collective delusion as it's studied today. And again, my effort here is to take these characteristics and see if we find them in the primary source documents of the New Testament.
Yeah, let's go through some of those. I mean, are these characteristics, you know, present in the early church? Let's look. What about paranormal beliefs?
Yeah, this is the hallmark one, because if obviously it ends up being the case that in some sense the apostles have adopted pagan belief in the paranormal, this becomes a plausible explanation for their belief, at least, that Jesus rose from the dead. But it's here we find something that's extremely important to actually understanding the entire Bible, all of Scripture. It's extremely important that we make a distinction between two worldviews. Back in the day, with regards to the Old Testament and the New Testament, there's only two worldviews that exist. You've got paganism, and you've got the Judeo-Christian view, the Christian view growing out of Judaism, obviously with some differences that we'll get into. But this is the distinction. And the Judeo-Christian view is very averse to or contrary to the pagan belief that exists during the Greco-Roman time period with regards to the New Testament. Paganism, as everyone knows, is really this interconnectedness with regards to all of reality. That is, you've got many deities, or what we might call polytheism. You've got many, obviously, human beings, and then you've got the world, nature itself. And it's all looked as this interconnected whole, very much like pantheism, which I know you've done a lot of work on. It's looked at everything as being one. And so affecting one of those things affects in some way or in some sense all of those things.
Once again, we've run out of time. Thank you for joining us here on Evidence and Answers. Our goal is to bring you the love of Christ and to equip you in your faith to always be ready to give a response. If you would like to hold an apologetics conference or series of teachings at your facility, contact Pat by calling him in Hawaii. That number is 483-0586. Or you may email him through the Evidence and Answers website. That's evidenceandanswers.org. Be sure to browse through our listing of topics on our site. We have everything from atheism to Zen Buddhism. You will also find articles and additional audio for you to listen to or download. An additional location to find Pat's messages is on YouTube. Look up Evidence and Answers and hit the subscribe button. To keep quality broadcasts like Pat's on the air, we rely on generous financial support from you, our listeners. Donating is simple. Just log on at evidenceandanswers.org. Evidence and Answers is grateful for one of our sponsors, the Honolulu Christian Church. If you don't have a home church and are looking for a place to grow in your faith, check out the Honolulu Christian Church. For service times, log in at honoluluchristian.org. Join us again next time on the air or online as we provide compelling reasons for faith in Christ. That's Evidence and Answers with Pat Zukeran. Wait.